So it's wonderful to ask the questions on pieces of paper. But before we start, it's an hour meditation. Is there any questions anybody would like to ask about the meditation? Just right ahead, right away. Yes. Okay, you're saying that you do have allergies, asthma, and so your breath is sometimes very hard to follow, very uncomfortable, very tough,
yes,
breathless.
I think it's, yes, it's true, I have allergies, but normally I don't have too much symptoms, and sometimes symptoms during meditation.
The symptoms arise during meditation. Now that's a common phenomena. It's just the same, I'll describe what I mean. I now want you, and other people as well, to please be mindful of the saliva in your throat. Now just let it go. You can't. Just a few moments ago, your saliva was quite natural, wasn't causing you a problem. But as soon as you put mindfulness on it, it becomes a problem. Because what happens with many people, unless you're a very skilled meditator, whatever you watch, you tend to control. You may not notice that, but you do. So the breath is probably, you may have asthma, the breath is going fine until you start looking at it, and then actually you do interfere with this natural process. And that happens with so many other things in our life. So sometimes one person told me, yes, he watches his breath, almost like out of the corner of the eye, like he's a spy, like MI5, because he can watch the breath without the breath knowing it's being watched. And he said, by doing that, his breath becomes natural, and it doesn't sort of interfere with the breath. It's the same way that now your saliva is natural again, because you forgot to look at it. But once you start looking at it, it does become unnatural. Because you actually interfere with it. It's a fascinating thing. So, one of the other ways which I would encourage you is actually to not go looking for the breath, to relax, calm the mind out, whichever way you want, and then let the breath come to you. It's something which I noticed with breath meditation. Every time I went to look at the breath, it was always hard and not comfortable. When I wasn't looking at it, it just was nice and soft. And it's always the case that, you know, I was, without even me realizing it, I was controlling it. But now, the way I meditate after so many years, I just relax, calm my mind, and then eventually just, you're aware of the breath, I don't even choose it. And then because I don't choose to watch the breath, it just comes to me. And it's always pretty natural, it's very easy to watch. My father suffered from asthma, I still have hay fever. Sometimes I can't breathe through my nose, breathe through my mouth. And I just don't even bother where it is and how hard it is, how short it is. I just try and sort of stand back and just watch it from a distance, like I was watching your breath, not my breath. And sometimes that tends to allow the things to become natural.
Yeah. Maybe asthma or something else, I don't know. Sometimes at the beginning of meditation, I scan my body from the bottom.
Yes, yeah. So you're saying that you also do the sweeping meditation, the scanning of the body at the very beginning, and when you come to your throat, it gets uncomfortable, you can never relax it.
Lose my mindfulness.
Use your mindfulness.
Feel like I stuck this place.
I feel like stuck. The reason I'm repeating this is so it can be go on the recorder, so other people can understand the answer once they've heard the question. Whenever you're giving a talk answering questions, sometimes the people ask a question and I give an answer, and all they ever hear on the recording is the answer. So they have to try and work out what the question was. So one thing to do is an obvious answer is when you sweep the body, just jump over the throat or the neck. Don't even bother to actually look at it. Because it's also the case, when you don't really bother looking at things, it usually relaxes. It's like when you go to sleep. When you go to sleep at night, the throat doesn't bother you at all. In fact, sometimes you're not paying any attention to it at all, and it's sort of wake up in the morning and there's no problem. So this is, again, the problem, that with mindfulness, people think it's just pure mindfulness. It ain't. We always interfere until we can learn how to watch with kindness. Kindfulness, I call it. So we can watch and leave it alone. Kindfulness on your throat, you say. Throat, you don't need to get any better. You can be totally, as you are, irritating, a pain in the neck, literally. And you can just stay there. I just love you who you are. Welcome, monster, in my throat. And that sort of kindfulness, so actually that does work. Because when you don't sort of try and control it, you accept it. You don't try and get rid of it. Then you find you're totally relaxed. If you try and get rid of it, it gets worse. You sort of try and just, okay, let it be. Then it tends to relax. It's a hard thing to do, to let pain be. Irritation. But experiment. That's what this meditation is about. Experiment, jump over it, just do a sweeping, just part of your body, but as soon as you get to your chin, to your shoulders, and ignore it if you possibly can. That might help. Is there any other couple of questions from the beginning?
A question on walking meditation.
Yes.
Where do you keep your awareness during walking?
Okay, well, usually, don't keep your awareness on your breathing, because you'll find that will disturb the walking. Most of the awareness is on your feet, but not 100%, because a little bit of awareness is just with your eyes watching where you're going. That's why I say 2 meters in front, not the left, not the right. And that tends to help you feel safe. You will see a boulder or a twig on the ground, so you will not actually step on it. It is helpful, if it's at all possible, to take off your shoes and socks. And just, I've got some more here, okay, very good. Take off, okay, yes, yeah. Just doing a couple first of all. Take off your shoes and socks so that you can actually feel the ground. Obviously that's so easy inside here. I don't know what the ground is like outside, but maybe have a check. And if it's comfortable, just take your shoes and socks off. Then you can actually feel the ground. It's so sensitive, it's beautiful. And that means also that you put your attention on your feet and on your legs. You can feel your skin touching the grass, or the carpet, or the tiles, or the wood, whatever's there. And so many different textures. You're getting mindful and aware of your body. It makes it very, very beautiful. Is that the last of the question? Is there something else? Okay, one more question. Wow! Okay, 1, 2, 3, and then we meditate.
To build your meditation practice,
yeah.
Do you recommend doing it at a particular time during the day so that...
Yes, there is. This was a question asked at Mary Ward Hall. It's a very common question. The best time to meditate and the worst time to meditate. And you probably know the answer. The best time to meditate is now. The worst time to meditate is later. So the best time to meditate, you know. So don't make a schedule and say, I have to meditate in the morning. It's just like, when do you eat? When you're hungry. Except here, of course. No, actually, it affects it in a muck. So here, just see if you can, just you feel, I need to meditate, and go for meditate. You make the time. So there's one question over there somewhere. Oh, yes, yeah.
Thank you for your teaching, Sajjan Brahm.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've attended a guided meditation.
Yes.
And sometimes when I kind of can see colorful swirls in front of me,
yeah,
like green and purple and all of that, should I always bring it back to the breath?
No, don't do anything. If those lights want to play around, let them be. So, one interesting, helpful way of doing meditation is to imagine you're a passenger, not the driver. So you don't control the meditation. You see a light, you don't say, oh, I'll get rid of this or I'll take it on. You just don't do anything. If your driver is going through busy traffic or other traffic, don't tell them which way to go. I'll always remember one of the early times I came to London, picked up at Heathrow Airport, and this young man was driving me. I was sitting next to him, and his mother was in the back. And his mother was worse than the GPS. Was always telling him, keep to the left, don't do so fast, just turn right here, turn right there. And then, you know, the archetypal backseat driver. I felt so sorry for the son. But don't be the backseat driving meditation either. Don't keep telling your mind, what's your best, what's your best, what's your best? No, no, do it this way. No, 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 stop, 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 stop. Don't be like that. Let go.
Okay, right. That's very helpful. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Just the one last question, then we meditate. Yes, at the back.
Thank you for the teaching. This morning when I was meditating, I wasn't nodding off, but I was leaning forward.
Yes.
The same as nodding off.
Yes, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But sometimes the movement of the body in meditation, when you're really aware, is just sometimes your body trying to heal itself, trying to get comfortable. Your body knows much more about how to heal itself and keep comfortable than you ever will. The body does it by itself. So I usually tell this story in a meditation retreat. What actually happens is that sometimes your body moves, it leans to the left or it twists around. If that happens, just let it happen. It's not a big thing. In fact, it's usually quite a positive thing. Standard story, I was alerted to one woman in one of my meditation retreats in Australia many years ago, was actually twisting around. And really twisting around, contorting herself. And sometimes I like to explain what I mean. I'm not going to do that, otherwise you'd have to take me to hospital. I mean, really, it would break my bones if I imitated what she did. And it was so extreme that I really was concerned for her. So I actually waited until she finished her meditation, took her aside and said, you know, are you okay? She said, I feel wonderful. I said, you actually really twisted around during the meditation, really twisted around. Was I? I was just peaceful. I didn't know what was happening. And then, of course, you know, I added to one and one, I should have realised this earlier. And I said, well, did you have your car accident? Because she was the victim of a very, very serious car accident, very lucky to come out alive, with so many internal injuries. And this is how her body heals. Somehow or other, the body needed to twist this way to open up channels of energy so they could go to the affected parts and heal them. Ordinary person doesn't need to do that, but her body knew what to do. That's why afterwards she felt great. So sometimes we've all had injuries and problems in our life, sort of stress injuries, emotional injuries, and physical injuries. And sometimes when we let go, we're not controlling our body anymore. So our body thinks, oh, at last she's out of the way. And now I can do my healing. So if you do twist around like that, just let it happen. It usually ends up, you're very comfortable afterwards. You mentioned that some stage during the meditation will lose 5 of your senses and also no longer be in control. Actually, you realise you're no longer in control, you never were. At this stage, are you still conscious and fully aware of what is happening? Yes, very much so. Or do you lose your awareness as if you've gone into a deep sleep? No way. If so, when do you become aware again? Also, do you need to have guidance on the teacher at these stages so you couldn't go astray or even mad? It must let me do the same, right? So I put them on mad. Stop nodding your head and say yes. Now this all comes back to Western culture. You know, sometimes other things like, you know, reincarnation and stuff, and I can't get it why people don't see this as an obvious thing. But a lot of people say, well, I just can't accept it. And it's all coming back from, we live in a very materialistic society, and I don't mean just stuff. I mean just the way we look at this world is just five physical senses. And the realm of the mind, we just ignore, as if it doesn't exist. As if it's just some byproduct of the brain. Now, you go back in history, because the Western culture always claimed to have got all of their original culture from the Greeks, especially philosophy. And you just have to look at Aristotle, who always said, yes, there are six senses. So we started off the first few centuries of the first millennium. Everybody knew there were six senses. You know, the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the sixth one was the mind. Aristotle said that is the common sense, because what the eye sees, so does the mind know. What you hear, what you smell, taste and touch, the mind knows. The mind is common to the other five. And my joke, which I mentioned in Mary Ward Hall, is that somehow the last 2,000 years Western culture has lost its mind and abandoned its common sense. We don't have a mind anymore. We don't have a common sense. You talk about in science, there's just five senses. So there is that sixth sense. That was, and interestingly, that and Plato's Republic, the last chapter of that book, all about reincarnation. They all believed in reincarnation, the Greeks. But it's actually the Christian Church in the Council of Nicaea. You don't know the story, it's interesting. But the Pope at the time, Pope Gregorius, I mean, Catholic place, should be okay though. Pope Gregorius, he was really into reincarnation. And when the Emperor said, no, you must declare reincarnation as a heresy, he refused. So the Emperor, this was in Byzantium, Constantinople, Emperor there, it's Istanbul, the Emperor there said, no, you have to declare it is a heresy. And the Pope refused. And the Emperor put the Pope in a jail. He put the Pope in jail for 12 months, until the Pope agreed to make it a heresy. So that's how things worked in those days. So from that time on it was a heresy. Before then the Christian Church, I think it was at 600 or something that happened. So the Christian Church originally believed in reincarnation and then later on abandoned it. And with it started abandoning the idea of a mind. So that when we have science, the mind was just shunted out of existence. It does not exist. So, but what happens is that when the five senses disappear, then you're face to face with the mind. It's the Buddha's simile, it's a simile of somebody refining gold. If you want to find out what the nature of gold is, you have to take away all of the other elements, you know, which are in that ore sample until you have pure 100% gold. Then you can actually test it, see its properties. But if there's other elements in there, then you can't really understand what real gold is. It's tainted, it's not pure, it's not 100%. Same way to understand what the mind is. The five senses totally vanish, the only thing left is the mind. And that experience is really conscious. The idea of you're asleep, you're not aware, is the total opposite. It's like for the first time you really are aware. And this awareness you have, and right now is just very dull and a mist, like half asleep. And I think I've already mentioned that this path of meditation, the path of stillness, what actually happens is you get more and more and more aware the closer you get into that realm of the mind. Really fully aware. How many of you were at the retreat at Mary Ward Hall? Less than a half. So here comes my gross story. It's coming again. You know what's coming. Those who heard this know what's coming. This is just what happens. The more aware you become, the more you see. And the more you see, the more beautiful it is. So this is just coming out of a deep meditation in my retreat center in Australia. And just like everybody else, I have to go to the toilet. It's just come out, incredible meditation, so aware, so mindful. And I had to go to the toilet to do what we call a number two. And after doing the business, I was very heedless. I should not have done this. I looked into the bowl to see what was floating in there. And honestly, never in my whole life have I ever seen such a beautiful piece of shit. Now, first of all, just the way it was like sculpted by some well-known old Michelangelo. Little balls which were stuck together with just the right shape. And the browns. It's not just one brown. Next time, have a look. There's so many different shades of brown on that thing floating in the toilet. And the way the colours interacted, again, was like some great painting. And there was always a little bit of mucus, you know, on the shit, which made it glisten like a diamond in the water. And then we come to the fragrance, rich, speaking of the earth itself. Not these fake fragrances we get in perfume bottles. This is real and earthy. Really speaking to the basic parts of human nature. Filling your nostrils with this incredible sense of the body and everything else. Wow, this is so amazing. And I really was looking at it for about 10 minutes. Going, wow, this is incredible. And I also say, and this is, I am being accurate here, I also contemplated many times picking it up and showing my friends. It did actually look beautiful, honestly, amazingly wonderful. Now this is just a piece of shit. And if you can see such beauty, and honestly just incredible beauty, in what is probably the most disgusting object you'd ever come across. You can imagine just the power of that mindfulness and how it can see so deeply into things that your old grandma becomes incredibly beautiful. Your husband, wow, he's so hot. Wow. Now I'm going a bit too far there. But you can actually see a lot of beauty where there's no beauty there before. Simply because you've woken up. So in those meditations, you are super aware. And this is one thing I'm really trying hard to introduce in our modern world, where mindfulness has become just so common in so many areas, but only people who meditate deeply understand that there's so many different levels of mindfulness. The ordinary mindfulness is actually very superficial. But it increases powerful mindfulness, superpower mindfulness. The powerful mindfulness can see the beauty of a piece of shit. The superpower mindfulness, while you can see everything. So in the deep meditations, you'll get to hear and you'll see this. You are 100 times more mindful, more aware than usual. Really conscious, really aware. It's the total opposite of being in deep sleep. Which is why we actually use that mindfulness. You come out afterwards, you are so sharp. If you want to get these things called enlightenment, that's the sort of mindfulness you need. To see really deeply into the nature of life. Because you are really super awake. And I want you to... People experience that. It's wonderful what you do. You know, follow this little path, being still. And after one of those deep meditations, sometimes you just can't go to sleep at night. You don't even want to go to sleep. You're just totally awake. Because you've really charged your mind up with incredible energy. So, no tiredness left at all. You've really empowered your mind. So, it is great states. And once you see that, you understand what this mind actually is. It's right in front of you. You're experiencing it. Powerful, beautiful, amazing. Because you've let go of the five senses. And if you want to do, I'm giving you all these tricks, so I want you actually to do this one day. That once you've had one of those really powerful experiences, really amazingly mindful, use it for some interesting stuff, like ask yourself, what is my earliest memory? Access your past lives. With that type of mind, it's not that hard to do. Just a little bit of a nudge, what's my earliest memory? They usually come to your childhood, when you were a baby. You're re-experiencing it, not like remembering what you had for lunch today. It's like you're eating your lunch again. Sitting here, but being able to re-experience the past. It's so similar to the memories people get under hypnosis, but this is more full, more powerful. And then you say, earlier please, and get your previous lives. And when you get that, it's real. You can investigate. You can ask yourself, what's my name? What's this place? What's the year? What's going on? And then you get all the details you need. And if you really want to, because now you get previous lives, it's not that long ago, you can actually go to the library and check it out. And that is really mind-blowing for you. When you actually get these memories, and write them down afterwards. Very easy to remember them. And then you go to the library and see if there really was a person by that name who married that person, who lived in that house in that time, who had this number of sons by this name at this date. And you find it all checks out. That is mind-blowing. People who follow me actually do that. And that means there's no doubt anymore that you lived before, you know it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what are celestial beings and do they exist in different realms? This is like the heavenly beings. Yeah, there are some connections between Christianity and Buddhism. You know, because actually I always say that, you know, Jesus almost certainly went to India. So there's a lot of connections. And heavenly beings, actually, what are they? If you don't know this story, I'll now tell you a heavenly being story. Real one, I know everyone involved in this. This happened in Thailand. Let's put a date on this. Because I know the people, probably about 30 years ago. Roughly about 30 years ago. There was an American young man. I'll give him his name because he's disappeared. His name was Doug. And he was working for the Peace Corps in Thailand. At the end of his stint in the Peace Corps, he thought he would stay a little bit longer by becoming a Buddhist monk and experiencing the culture of a monk. Now, basically complete his overseas experience in that land. But he didn't know, how do you become a monk? What do you do? He was staying in a hotel just to the north of Bangkok. And so he asked a concierge. Now, concierges know a lot of stuff which Westerners are interested in. But that's not the sort of stuff he was wanting to do. He wanted to become a monk. So the concierge actually gave some, half-accurate advice. He said there was a monastery in the center of Bangkok, it's called Wat Bawan. And sometimes you find some Western monks staying there. So he said, that's the place to go. And the way to become a monk is take some food, and when the monk, early in the morning, when the monks come out for their alms round, put some food in one of the monk's bowl and then say, I would like to become a monk, please help. They said, that's the way to do it. This is totally wrong, but nevertheless, that's what this young man did. But the mistake he made was going really early in the morning, about 4 o'clock. Yeah, monks get up at that time, but don't go on alms round until about 6:30. So, and the monastery was all locked up. So he's walking up and down the road, which I know really well. Up and down that road, everything was locked up, very few people around at that time of the morning, wondering what the heck to do. And then a Thai gentleman approached him and asked him, what are you doing? And the Thai gentleman spoke perfect English. And what are you doing? When he said that he wanted to become a monk and this is what he was told to do, the Thai gentleman said, look, it's way too early. The monks are not going to come out until another couple of hours. But, said this Thai gentleman, I can let you in the monastery because I've got a key and I can show you around for a couple of hours. So this Thai gentleman took out a bunch of keys from his pocket and opened up this gate and went into the monastery and into the short path which led to the main hall, where it's called the ordination hall. Basically, it's the centre of the monastery. And there he turned on the lights and opened the hall and took this young American on a tour around the temple. Now, many of you know that those Thai temples have paintings on the wall. And you have to be very smart to actually to know what those paintings mean. It's like a cartoon, but in the West, a cartoon, you start from the left and go to the right until you get to the end part of the cartoon. And they're in little frames. First of all, there are no frames in these murals, and they go all over the place, not necessarily linear. And they usually are stories from the time of the Buddha, or what they call the Jataka tales. And even I sometimes look at them, and you have to sort of try and figure out which way to go to actually to find the whole story. If you know the story well, you can figure it out. But this Thai gentleman, he knew everything about these murals, not just know how to read them and what the story meant, but also actually who donated them, who actually paid for them. And it's always because of, you know, they lost a son, you know, to typhoid, or more likely malaria, or, you know, to celebrate a birth of a child or something. There was always some meaning why they gave a donation to unpainted that mural in this big hall. And the American said, it's really fascinating, all that information. Time flew by. When they got to the last painting, the Thai gentleman timed it perfectly. He said, now I will lock up, turn off the lights, you go through the gate and go to the right, and then about another 10 minutes or so, there'll be an elderly monk comes by. He is the one to put food in the bowl and ask to become a monk. And this is what that American man did. So he was taken inside afterwards, after asking this monk to start the training to be a monk. There's a lot of training to be done before you can be ordained. So they appointed one of the other monks to be his like mentor. And after 2 or 3 days, the American complained his mentor monk was too hard to understand. His English was too poor. And he asked, can I have another mentor to teach me the basics of being a monk? To which the monk said, this monk, he's the best English speaker in the whole temple. And that was the point where the American said, what about that temple man who met me on the first day, who opened the gates and gave me the tour around the temple? There is no such gentleman, said the monk. And when he described the full story, they took him straight to the abbot of the monastery, who became a famous monk. He died about 2 or 3 years ago. He became the head monk of Thailand, Venerable Somdet Nyanasangwara. So they took him to this monk who was then the abbot. And as soon as he started relating the story, the abbot stopped him, called in the secretary and to write it all down. Because not only is no such gentleman, that the gate through which he came is called the Royal Gate. Only kings and royalty can come through that gate. No monk can. I know that gate. I was hanging out there for a long time. And no layperson has those keys. The abbot and secretary have the key. The same with the main hall. There's only a couple of monks can actually have the keys to open that hall, not a layperson. And interestingly, he cannot turn on the lights where he said he turned on the lights. And even the old abbot did not know all of the history of those paintings. So the whole thing was totally weird. And having written down this American monk story, the abbot then asked him the obvious question, what did this man look like? And if you are a Westerner in Thailand, you probably answer the same. They all look the same. I don't know what you're like. But he did say he was wearing not modern dress, but old-fashioned traditional Thai costume, which was interesting at that time of the morning. But can you give him some description of what he looked like? Now, when you're thinking, very often you're scratching your head and looking around for inspiration. And that's when this American monk stopped and froze. Because there were paintings on the walls, portraits. It was him. That was who he was. The painting on the wall was a painting of King Wongkun. That was him. A king, 150 years ago, he knew all about that third temple because he built it. He was a monk for many years before he actually came to the throne. He built that temple and he knew all about the paintings and he could go through that gate because he was a king. And that is part of the history of that temple. A person who died many, 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 many years ago, coming out to help someone become a monk, just like your Sri Lankan traditional Buddhist you read in the suttas. In the time of the Buddha, that's the sort of thing which happened. An ex-king came to help a monk open doors which cannot be opened, turn lights on but you can't turn them on, and know all about all the details about these paintings. I've checked that out many times. It's a real story. There's no embellishments there at all. That's what a deva is. Sometimes you'd be sitting next to one and you wouldn't laugh. And suddenly they disappear. I often think, I've told Venerable Chanda this, and I've actually told quite a few people this. For some reason, I have got myself involved in supporting female ordination. And it's not just, you know, ordaining, it's making sure they have a place to stay, a monastery. And so when I decided to get a place for women to stay and ordain and live the monastic life properly in Perth, Australia, where I live, it's so hard to do, you know, to get a place. You've got to raise funds, first of all, practical things. So we were raising funds, you know, $10 here, $20 there. It's really slow. And the thing, the time which really turbocharged this project was when a man arrived in the monastery where I live. He wanted to see me. He was wearing jeans, t-shirt and just thongs. Not the sort of dress you'd expect for what was going to happen later. And he announced to me that his wife had just given birth to his first child, who happened to be a daughter. And he said he wanted to do something, you know, to celebrate the birth of his first child. He said he was a Buddhist. And he said, I hear that you are raising funds to build a monastery for women here in Australia. Now, my daughter probably won't ever want to become a nun, but if she does, I want her to have a place where she can do that, to have the freedom. If she wants to be a Buddhist nun, there's a place there for her. So I want to make a donation. And he handed over a cheque for $250,000 Australian dollars. I've never seen a bigger cheque like that. And then, sort of, he disappeared, and I've never seen him again. I don't know what's happened to him. And that was such a weird thing. Out of the blue, somebody came, and from that moment on, we had, you know, the heart donation of that monastery. Sometimes I wonder whether that was also a heavenly being, a deva. These you don't know. They don't look like wings on the back and weirder like you might see in the movies. They take the form of a human being to do some service to help you out. Other people have had similar experiences. People coming out from nowhere, saving their lives, or whatever. And they're disappearing forever. So that's real heavy being stuff. You mentioned that it's not necessary to time things, but does it not help to organize your life? Oh yeah, in your life, fine. But not during meditation. This is like different. This is freedom from all of that. Yeah, in a couple of days, I'm supposed to go to Heathrow to get on a plane to go back to Perth. Then I really do need to look at the clock. But when you're here, isn't it wonderful to be free of time? When I was a monk in Thailand, there's no need for any time. You have bells. The only way you know the time of the week is actually to look at the moon. So we always run on a lunar cycle. And after about 4 or 5 years, absolutely no exaggeration, I forgot, didn't really know what year it was. It didn't really matter to me anymore. There was such a lovely change of perception going into a timeless, because it was a timeless existence. If things have been doing the same for hundreds of years in those forest monasteries, you know, before it got developed. And it was very beautiful being timeless. But then what happened when I came from Thailand to Australia? There was a gentleman who came to the temple and he had an epileptic fit. So we called the ambulance, I tried to look after him as best as possible. But then the ambulance man asked him, the first question is, what day is it today? He didn't know. And because of that, that showed that he was a bit out of his mind. And they took him to the hospital. And I found out that was such a common question. If they'd have asked me, they'd have taken me to the hospital. So after that, I decided I'd better get sort of a watch, I'd better know what day it is. Otherwise, I don't fit in. So, yeah, there's times when you actually organize your life, but don't organize yourself too hard. Your plans should be made of rubber, not of concrete. So you can always change when it's an obvious thing to do so. People sometimes, lives are so intricately planned, you can't adapt. But when you adapt, you become much more alive, much more successful, and much more in tune with the life, which always does change. So little simple things, as like at 7 o'clock I felt I needed to see any questions rather than just go straight into meditation. I think that worked. I'm always going to be changing a little bit. Anyway, as I've heard, Buddha was a very disciplined person who got up early and had set time to do things. Where did you hear that from? That's not true. So people have such a different idea of what the Buddha was. People told me that the Buddha had long ears, he had his big bump on the front of his head, he was really tall, that he really stood out. But the truth of the matter is many times in the suttas, these are the descriptions, where no one knew who the Buddha was. One of the most wonderful times was when there was a monk who was ordained by one of the Buddha's disciples who went to the far west of India. And having been ordained by one of the Buddha's disciples, once he got his basic training completed, now he formed an idea, a wish to go and see the Buddha. Buddha was still alive. And so he had to travel by foot from the west coast of India to the Ganges Valley and then find the Buddha there. And so he'd been travelling many weeks, and on the journey you sleep wherever you can. And he came to a worker's shack, and there it seems that where the worker lived with his family, they usually had like what we call like a lean-to, just a piece of a roof, you know, just against the house, open on all sides, and that's where he would work. And he at least it will protect you from any rain. So the monk said, "Is it okay if I sleep in your workshop tonight?" And the owner said, "Yeah, certainly, no problem at all." He got some straw for the monk to sleep on. And a short time later, another monk turned up, and the other monk asked the same, "Is it okay if I can sleep in this workshop, this big workshop? I won't really be intruding on you, monk." So the two monks were there together. And the monk from the west coast started meditating, so the visiting monk also started meditating. And you know what it's like, so you open your eyes, he's still meditating, I better meditate as well. So they both meditated throughout the night. And when the night ended, the monk from the west said, "Wow, you're a really good meditator, you didn't move." And the other monk said, "Yeah, you're pretty good too." And so the monk from the monk who came second said, "Who's your teacher?" And this monk said, "Oh, I came from the west of India. My teacher is a disciple of the Buddha himself. I'm on my way to see the Buddha." And "Who's your teacher?" And the monk arrived second said, "I've got no teacher. I am the Buddha." "Ah, I've been with the Buddha all night. I never paid respect up to him. Sorry." And he did know who the Buddha was. And I thought that's a nice story to say that the Buddha looked like another monk. He didn't have a special robe, like, you know, like you have in the army with pips and crowns on the, or like stripes, like a sergeant and a corporal. He looked totally the same. So, and that was actually the Buddha. So, and wouldn't disorganization lead to chaos in the world? Actually, organization leads to chaos. But actually, you have to find a middle way, a bit of organization, a bit of disorganization. That's one of the reasons why I love Buddhism. It was totally disorganized. If you like organized religion, then don't be a Buddhist. Buddhism is disorganized religion. Now, you go to any of the ceremonies, some of it is just, it's actually chaos. You know, Sri Lankan temple, Thai temple, you know, yeah, he's supposed to have a sort of schedule, at this time we'll do something, at that time we'll do something, but people always arrive late, and you know, the monks don't come out on time, and it's all sort of a mess, but it's enjoyable, because it's real. But you go to one of these ceremonies, like the Queen's 90th birthday, everything is choreographed to the last step. And it's just so fake when it's choreographed, like, there's no life to it. I do funerals and marriages. It's when things go wrong, they are the most memorable marriages and funerals. You know, when all the plans all go totally wrong. Like, doing a funeral for a Chinese Buddhist. And then, you know, the Chinese, they really just go way over the top with things like the coffee. They have to have the very best with all the stuff on the outside, handles and baubles and gold and stuff. So, when they were actually lowering it down the hole, it got stuck halfway. And the poor funeral directors, they couldn't lower it, it was stuck, they couldn't pull it out, it was jammed halfway down the the grave. And I was trying to go to the time, trying to make sure, and they couldn't get it out. They couldn't. That was a very memorable funeral. Oh, another one for Steve and Jenny. Steve, rather. Jenny was his partner. There's many other stories about that death, but there was, you know, one of these funeral parlors where you put it on the conveyor belt, and it goes through, a door opens up, it goes through, and the door closes behind it. Now, poor old Steve was a whitewater rafter, and this is the law in Australia, you can make your own coffin. It has to be a certain size. But they made the coffin out of this hardwood called jarrah, which is really heavy. So it really took them a lot. Almost a few other people died lifting it out of the hearse and putting it on the conveyor belt. But they got it on there. And then when they pressed the button for it to go through, it was so heavy, the motors actually couldn't actually move the conveyor belt at a proper speed. So it went halfway through. The screen opened up, but before the coffin had gone totally through, the screen came back and jammed the coffin. So the coffin again was half in, half out. And Jenny, being a very practical girl, immediately jumped up and on top of the coffin and started pushing it through. To which her friend says, "You want to get rid of him that badly?" And one of his friends says, "Yeah, that's typical Steve. You know, the first time he got his car, the very first day he crashed it, first day in his coffin, and he's crashed that too." That was one of the best funerals I've ever been to. Memorable, because everything went wrong. And marriages. I can't actually perform the marriage, but I'm with the marriage celebrant to actually do the blessings. And so I was doing the blessings and chanting, and this guy Dennis was doing the actual marriage. And then he did all the ceremonies. This has had to be by law. There's many things you have to do. It has to be legal. And the very, very end, so that towards the end, he said, "I now pronounce you man," and that's when I interrupted him. He said, "Dennis, rings. You haven't done the rings yet." No, he thought about the wedding rings. He got everything else right, but, you know, I thought his mind went blank. And that was the wedding where they didn't exchange rings. Crazy stuff. The rings were in the pocket, but he forgot all about it. So, and those are marriages which I remember because they're absolutely stupid, they all go wrong. When it goes wrong, that's life, that's real. And that makes it memorable and so much more joyful. So please, let things go wrong a bit in life. That is good fun. We have a marvellous time. Don't be too organised. Okay. Also, isn't there a posture that helps in meditation, i.e. erect posture? No, the only part of your body which is important when you meditate is your mouth. Turn up the edges. That's good posture. That's bad posture. That is not, I'm not being a joke, that actually works. Because you have some happiness on your face, the happiness goes into your mind, and you get much better meditation. And lastly, you state that it's not necessary to strive, but did not the Buddha try hard to attain enlightenment? He tried for 6 years, and he got nowhere. Which is why he said, "Don't do that," afterwards. And what happened? Anyone listen to him? No. Look, this is, I agree that it's counterintuitive. To get in line without striving, just to let go. But that is the reason why many people don't get in line. Because they're striving. And if you ever go to any of these places where they strive, the teachers are really control freaks, and they get angry at you, they shout at you, they use Zen sticks. They don't get enlightened, honestly. It is, Ajahn Chah was never like that at all. That's why it was just so wonderful to see these monks, so incredibly kind. It's more kindness than, I'm just remembering some of these monks, as being in their presence, you never wanted to leave. You say you're going to have to drag me away, I'm going to die here. Because you felt so accepted for who you were. You didn't have to try and change and improve yourself. Just be who you are. Open the door of your heart to yourself. Stop trying to strive to change things. And then all those attainments happen. Ajahn Chah's great simile, which is one of his best, told it in every retreat. He said, the monastery where Ajahn Chah was living, what he set up, was called Wat Ba Pong. He said it's a mango orchard. Trees were planted by the Buddha, he said. It was a metaphor. And there's so many ripe, delicious mangoes on those trees right now. But if you shake the tree, the mangoes will never fall. If you throw sticks up to get the mangoes down, the mangoes won't fall. If you try and climb the tree to reach the mangoes to pick them, you just can't reach them. Even if you get a ladder to try and pluck the mangoes, the ladder's never tall enough. He said there's only one way to get the mangoes from the trees planted by the Buddha. That is to sit perfectly still under the mango tree and open up your hand and a mango will fall. That was Ajahn Chah's simile. Absolutely brilliant. Counterintuitive. If you try that with a real mango tree, you'll be there for days. If a mango falls, it'll fall on your head before it goes in your heart and hand. That is stupid. But, and actually when I first heard it, I just dismissed it. I thought, that is absolutely rubbish. But I remembered it for years. And then, you know, when this meditation started to take off, and you see, wow, that is so true. Sit perfectly still. Open up, not your hand, your heart, kindness, and then the mangoes fall. Everything you heard about these meditations, enlightenment, insight, psychic powers, the whole works, it falls only when you're still. Some people say, Ajahn Brahm, I tried that, it doesn't work. What do you mean it doesn't work? Well, I was being still and nothing fell. You weren't being still, you wanted something. That's not being, come on, I'll be still for now, come on, let a mango fall. That's not being still, that's wanting. So this is where you really have to be still. Yes, go ahead. I'll explain it, no brain. In other words, it is stillness. People who get that still, your brain stops working. Both sides become still. What a Maya. Okay, that's some stories, entertainment on the night. Guy called Greg. He told me this story just after it happened. He was just an ordinary lay meditator, been there about 40, 45 minutes, that's about all. Sunday afternoon, nothing on the TV, told his wife, I'm going to meditate in the bedroom. Off he went, an hour and a half, I forget exactly how long, but he hadn't come out from the room. So his wife went to check on him, and saw him sitting perfectly still. I mean, really still. I mean, too still, he wasn't breathing. So she called the ambulance. The ambulance came within a few minutes, rushed into the room. He was still sitting perfectly still there, hadn't moved. Checked his pulse, could not find any pulse, no breath. So they put him straight in the back of the stretcher. Back of the ambulance, his wife was in there as well, worried like hell. Took him to the hospital, put on, it was a Sunday afternoon, put on an ECG on his heart. It was flatlined, there was no heartbeat. And put on an EEG on his brain. And that was also flat. There's no brain activity. He was brain dead. But he was warm. And the doctor was from India. He was actually born in Australia, but the doctor's parents had come from India. And he always heard that sometimes in deep meditation you can suspend your life's activities. He'd never seen that before. But there was a patient, an Australian, who, his wife said, was meditating. And now there's no brain activity, no heart activity. But the weirdest thing was he was still warm. And if you ever look at the Chöda Wetland Sutta, that's exactly what the Buddha says. Now that's the difference between being dead and being in deep meditation. And so what did this doctor do? Give him defibrillate him with electric shocks on his chest. Boom! 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 Many times apparently according to his wife, nothing worked. Until he just decided to come out of his meditation. And as soon as he opened his eyes, he leapt up, opened his eyes, beep, beep. Both machines were normal. Normal heartbeat, normal sort of brain activity. And the doctor gave him a thorough checkup. This is no exaggeration. Sometimes you like to exaggerate stories, but I'm keeping it exactly as he told me. The doctor gave him a thorough checkup. He couldn't find absolutely nothing wrong with him, so didn't even keep him in overnight. He walked back home with his wife. He said the only unpleasant part of that experience was the scolding he got from his wife on the way back home. Don't you ever do that again. I was so scared, I thought you were dead. You know, you can imagine that, your husband or your wife, or maybe some people's husbands saying, oh, why did you come back? But he was really scolded. And all the time, I asked him, well, were you unconscious? He said, no way. I've never been so awake in my life. So blissed out. Incredible happiness. And that was the deep dharmas. So that's what happens. So, that's what happens when you get to deep meditation. So if that is you, and you get some good meditation, please tell the people you love, don't put me in a box and bury me yet. Just please check if I'm warm. If I'm warm, just leave me alone. But that's it, your brain just stops. It's no brain. We're pushing medical knowledge much further than people understand. You know, when we get into the world of the mind. The mind has got nothing to do with the brain. It uses the brain but doesn't have to. How many people, here we go. How many people have been with someone who's dying, their last moments? Great. How many of them have been in the coma? How many of those in a coma woke up in the last minute? Sorry?
Smiled.
Smiled, okay. Because it's actually more common than people understand. In a coma, the brain is basically not working at all. But so often it happens that they haven't been able to speak or do anything for days in a coma. The last moments, they open their eyes. One example, there was two of my, actually one of them was a disciple, comes over to our temple, Australians, they're Caucasians. Sister never really came by, but their father was dying. And if you've been with someone who's dying, you never know when it's going to happen. They're really breathing, they're in a coma, sort of breathing, and then suddenly the breathing stops. You think that's it, and then they start breathing again. Again, again, again that happens, until finally the breath goes out. And pauses, and think this is it, and they breathe again. But finally, the time comes, they breathe out, and that's it. They're dead. But they're waiting for that moment, holding their father's hand, on the side of the bed. You know, many times they thought he'd gone, but then breathed again. And then he opened his eyes, leant up, and looked at his two daughters. And they said, we love you, Dad. And then he fell back and died. And that's how he ended. He was clear at the very end. That is more common than people accept. That's actually very common. There's no brain, they're in a coma, and they use something else to say hello to everybody. Recently, just about a few months ago, one of the doctors told me in Australia, one of his patients, cancer patient, you know, he underestimated how sick she was. She thought she had another few days before she died. But then went to check up and he saw the dying process was starting. So he frantically, he told me, he got on the bedside phone, got out this woman, yeah, it was a woman, got out this woman's address book to ring up, call up as many family as possible quickly to tell them, look, your mum's dying, come quick, she's dying, you haven't got time, come immediately. And he was calling one of the daughters on the phone, told her, your mum, you know, the dying process has started, come now. And at that, the woman sort of opened her eyes and said, tell Julie I love her. She heard the conversation, said those words, closed her eyes and died. Awake at the very end. And that is very common. And what that's happened is the brain is gone, the mind can actually take over for a little while before it goes. So anyway, amazing experiences of the mind, totally independent of the brain. And this is actually what we can actually access when we go to deep meditation. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what is your opinion of the importance of the nature in our practice? Nature, it's, I'm not quite sure what you mean the nature of a person, or flowers and trees or something. But look, quite honestly, that if you want to meditate, you close your eyes, you leave the world. Sometimes nature can be quite inspiring. One of the reasons is that nature moves so slowly. So you go for a walk in the forest, that it's totally different than walking down the high street. The high street's always very busy, but nature is usually very calming. You know this psychologist over in Sydney, and he's making a fortune. His therapy for people with depression and anxiety. If you get an angle in psychology, you can make a lot of money. There's so many people anxious, tense, and all he does, he takes them in his car out to the ocean side, the beach, the forest, and they go for a walk together, and they come back afterwards and they feel so much better. And you charge them, that's $1,000, please. And you can do that by yourself. He calls it nature therapy. There's a bit of a scam, but it works. So look, if you are anxious, depressed, stressed out, just go to King's Park, Richmond Park, just around the corner here. Have a walk in nature. You will always feel so much better afterwards. There's something about nature which calms us down, which is beautiful, joyful. You see maybe a little deer over there messing around, and it just brings you happiness and joy. It's called nature therapy. So that's very good in psychology. He has to sort of do some telling about his research and what happened, and it actually works. I think if that's not what you meant, you have to ask another question, because it's a bit too wide for me to narrow in on your meaning. Well, questions, my goodness. How does one keep sustained attention in the present moment? By relaxing and by kindness. I think I mentioned to you, if you're with your best friend, who's really kind to you, then you like to stay with them for a long time. You like to do things together. If you're with an enemy, you can't get away from them soon enough. So if you want attention to the present moment, you've got to love the present moment, be kind to the present moment, respect the present moment, become a friend to the present moment. When you're best friends, present moment, has such a good time together, of course you stay together. That's how you keep sustained attention, not through will, but through friendship. I have experienced deep meditation but no nimitta. Does it mean I will not experience nimitta in the future, or was it not deep meditation in the first place? Haven't sort of got enough information to know it's a deep meditation. Usually see a nimitta, but not always. It still could have been a deep meditation. The nimitta is a light which comes up in the mind, but sometimes the light happens, you didn't notice it. How does one make meditation enjoyable? If it wasn't enjoyable, it was not a deep meditation. Enjoyable is part of being a deep meditation. You look at the way the Buddha taught, 16 stages of Anapanasati, the best meditation, number 5, number 6, number 7, number 8, is experiencing joy, experience happiness, experience both of those things, calming it down a little bit, refining it. You're supposed to develop happiness in meditation, that are 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th stages, and it stays with you all the way through. Same as suttas, to tell everybody, I know what I'm talking about, I don't make this up, this is part of the whole textual tradition of Buddhism, as well as the experiential tradition. Dhamma, Chaitanya Sutta, monuments of the Dhamma, Majjhima Nikaya, there King Pasenadi went to visit the Buddha in the Jetavana monastery outside of Sarvati. You can go and visit there these days, they've uncovered everything. It's one of the places you go for pilgrimage. And the king was talking to the Buddha and said to the Buddha, how much is life in his life he like coming to this monastery? Why do you like coming here, king? Said the Buddha. Because in this monastery, all the monks, it's a monk's monastery, all the monks are happy and smiling. That's why I like coming. That's an amazing statement to say that if you meditate properly, you can get happier and happier and happier, which is part of it. So meditation is, by its nature, enjoyable. So develop the joy. Don't be afraid of the joy. Some monks, and they're really, not called bad monks, but saying bad things, they say, you'll get attached to the joy. You're meant to get attached to the joy. That's supposed to be what's supposed to happen. It's the other things, the other attachments, is what you're supposed to worry about. Because if you get attached to the joy of meditation, only 4 things are possible for you. The first stage of enlightenment, the second stage of enlightenment, the third stage of enlightenment, the fourth stage of enlightenment. That's in the Pasadika Sutta. Well, Anapana, we've got here. Anapana step 5, arousing joy. How do you do that? By being still. The more still you are, the more joy comes up. Be silent. Element of joy there. Stay silent long enough. Wow, this is beautiful. This is delicious. And that's only the start. Yes. You give me the one finger sign. That's just going to ask a question, come on.
When I meditate, what do you do is I'm trying to do with me. And my breath has nothing to do with me either. Is that perspective correct? It's like my breath is more powerful than me, it survives.
Excellent. That's helpful, because when it's separate from you, you tend not to control it.
It's
good, laughing at yourself, but the joy becomes much more deeper than that, the laughter. And it happens to me, it's happened to many meditators, sometimes you get really scared. No human being can take so much pleasure. That happened to me years ago, and other people have probably told me the same. I said, yeah, I remember that.
Well, when you
say
the stillness, it's like your body has nothing to do with it.
No, that's exactly it. So it becomes totally still. It's like you drop it, it's not moving. And then the mind becomes still. Wow. Nothing is moving. That's power. It's not freaking you out. This is what's going to happen to you. Okay, marketing to make your number freak out. Still a lay person, university, had a girlfriend, a nice girlfriend, good sex, sleeping with her. This was 73, I think, 72, 73. 72. 71. 71, I think. 71, and had a really nice time up in Gloucester, and then I left her in Gloucester to go on a meditation retreat. About 4 or 5 days later, nice meditation, and the bliss was much better than sex with your girlfriend. Good sex with your girlfriend, this was way better. That really blew my mind. How can that happen? The pleasure was longer lasting, deeper, richer. And there's no complications. And I was like, fascinated. What on earth is... Why didn't anyone tell me about this before? That's what I'm telling you. It's much better than sex. Now you understand what it means by having some fun. And that's only the start. It gets much better than this. Yeah.
Within sort of the first month of sort of practicing meditation, I've never seen jhanas, so I kind of had an out-of-body experience.
Out-of-body, oh yeah.
Kind of watching myself.
From above, yeah.
Myself, which was then, I was blissed out for the next sort of week or so.
Oh, yeah.
I sort of struggled quite a lot to find the time to do meditation, kind of use it as a kind of resetting myself.
Yeah.
Just sort of 10 minutes here and there to sort of set everything down. Being here, I've started to get the same sort of feeling, but as soon as it comes in, it's sort of too intense for me.
Yeah.
And then my mind just switches off and I'm just kind of falling asleep there.
Yeah. So what you need to do to overcome that, a little bit of fear or excitement, the two big problems that develop in the deeper meditation. Something's happening.
It's excitement. It's too much.
Okay, look, next time, it's not too much, you can have good fun, don't worry about it, it's brilliant. Totally safe, you're with the expert on this. So, to overcome that, if you want to, before you meditate, every time before you meditate, say, when that state comes up, I will not be excited. When it comes up, I will not be excited. When it comes up, I will not be excited. In your own words, much slower than I said, pay attention to them, then forget it. You're reprogramming your mind. And you'll be amazed how powerful that is. You get to that stage where you usually get excited, and that program just kicks in. You don't get excited, so you can go further and deeper. You're perfectly safe. Actually, I've got to be honest with you, there is a danger if you get into those deep meditations. The danger is you might lose your hair. You really start thinking about becoming a monk, obviously. Because, you know, if you get a bliss better than sex by meditating...
I'd love to become a monk, but...
You've got family.
Kids
to... Okay, look after your kids first, well, they're important. But it is those types that give you a huge understanding about what's available for human beings. And sometimes people think, being a monk, being a nun, what are you a monk for? That must be really difficult. You can't do this, you can't do that. That's why they call them nuns. None of this, none of that. So I'm jealous of you. But, you know, you just have so much happiness. You know, just sitting alone in your hut. You know, there are incredible meditations. So, whew, you asked me that question, joy. Really amazing. So this is how you do that, it just happens. When you did your 6 month meditation, did you set any goal? This is when I did 6 months of absolute solitude. Didn't see a human being for 6 months. Never spoke to anyone for 6 months. Did you set any goal? No, goals are the ones which kill you. Do you set goals on a regular basis in those months? Absolutely not. When you set a goal, it stresses you. You're not still anymore. Will you please explain what is... Oh, really, I've got questions here. Ekagata citta, oneness of mind. It's not oneness of mind, it's ekagata. Ta means ness, N-E-S. The same when we take a noun like sleepy and sleepiness. You got like, so it just makes an abstract noun. And eka means one, and it's not one, it's agga. And the Blessed Pali word, agra, the Sanskrit equivalent, which you may know, is agra. Has anyone heard the word agra before?
Yeah.
Taj Mahal, Red Fort. It was a capital of India under the Mughals, the Mughal Empire, Akbar and all his people, because that was the peak, the summit, the capital of India at that time, Agra. So it literally means the one major peak of the mind, not just oneness, a huge summit of perception. So it's not just an order just being one, you're really blissing out in a huge summit of the mind. I do feel metta, development of unconditional love for living beings, but find it difficult to generate high levels of metta to be able to go deeper into meditations, how to generate more metta. It's sometimes people don't understand what metta is. They start chanting, may all beings be happy and well. That's not metta. What if beings do not want to be happy and well? Sometimes you say, may you be happy and well. They say, no, I'm not going to follow what you ask me to do. I said, well, I'm an independent being. If I want to be miserable, I demand my right to be miserable. You're independent. So when I chant metta to someone, I say, may you be happy and well if you want to. It's up to you. If you don't want to be, I still love you and care for you. That's metta. How many times do people say, have a wonderful day? That is putting their ideas on you, trying to control you. So when people ask to tell me, have a wonderful day, I say, no, on principle, I will not. I'm not going to follow other people tell me to do. This is not North Korea, this is England. It's opening the door of your heart, that's more metta, so you allow things to be. You don't necessarily make sure they're well and happy. Like when you go and visit someone in hospital, hope you get better soon. That is a terrible thing to say to someone. Now you put stress on them. I've got to get better. So this person who spends all this time coming to visit me, sacrifices so much of their evening to come to visit me by my bedside, they say, may I become better? And I don't. I feel so guilty. It stresses them. So you say to the person on the bedside, you can get better if you want. It's up to you, but I'll always care for you and love you. So you give them freedom. You don't lay a trip on them and force them to be something. Much nicer. You can get better if you want. It doesn't matter. I'm still your friend. So next time you say, good morning, Ajahn Brahm, I'll say, no. I can have a bad morning just to spite you. You're quite, if when you get to the breath, you're neither going inwards nor outwards, but stays with that breath, you won't develop anymore. So try and get inwards in the present, closer to the silence. How? It's natural, just when you watch a TV, you tend to go in to the center of things. It's just that's a natural zooming in of the mind. So if you're just watching anything, just as long as you stay still, you'll start focusing in the center. Do various breathing exercises in yoga help in going into deep meditation? I don't know. I don't do yoga. Is deep meditation and jhanas the same? Sometimes I am really not allowed to say if I get jhanas or not, so I try and get the loophole. I say I just do deep meditation. So it could be jhanas, it could not be jhanas. Otherwise, if I said they were the same, I'd get in trouble. Can someone get into deep meditation without nibbitas first? Yes, but nibbitas are the best. Would you please recommend a meditation center in or near London which follows your meditation method? Yes, it's called YouTube. Would you please tell us about past lives that some monks have recalled and have narrated to you without naming the monks, of course? Okay. There's a lot of questions, should I answer them all? Okay. I could do. Meditation, maybe I'll do that tomorrow. Okay, wait now. Okay, this is a man, you would know him in Perth, a venerable Chanda. This was actually under hypnotic regression, not under meditation. And he was a soldier in the Navy Reserve. And he just finished an exercise, an anti-terrorist exercise. And he went to get regressed. Not that he was interested, but his brother was having some psychiatric problems. And he wanted to see if regression would help his brother. So he thought he would try it first of all, just to check it out. He made the appointment, but he went on his exercises first. And that was really important because he was actually exhausted. His defenses were down, which was why of the first time the hypnotist, he got into a previous life. And a previous life was also in Western Australia, in the port of Fremantle, where he saw he was dressed in a brown uniform, which he'd never seen before, and saw red coat British soldiers on the pier. All of it was really weird because there shouldn't be red coats there, and brown, he didn't know what the heck that was. And that started the regressionist was a very skillful guy, really close friend. And he started asking the questions, who are you, got the name, who are you married to, got his wife's name, where did you meet, at a pub in Fremantle, where did you live, he got the place where he lived, and he got all the information that he joined the British, I'll tell you the whole story. This he had to piece together afterwards by going to the library. There was a certain type of soldier who was volunteered to look after the prisoners which were sent to Australia. They were the brown uniform ones. The Redcoats, they were there at the very beginning of the colonisation of Australia, but then they never appeared again because they stopped wearing those red coats. So he was correct. At that particular time, there were red coats in Fremantle. His brown uniform, he went to the library. There's only one photograph in the library of these. That was it. He saw them. He went to the church, which kept the register of marriages. There, his name was down there with his wife at the time he said he got married. After 3 years of working, looking after prisoners, then he could retire, given a grant of land to try and develop the colony. So he got the land, he knew exactly where it was in its regression, down in the south of Western Australia, just north of Albany. He went to the lands office and there it was, the land deed in his name, he said under a hypnosis. He went there with the regressionist later on, because the regressionist was really interested. Let's see if we can find the place you lived so many years ago. So they went down there, and had to ask the farmer for permission to check where the house was, and the farmer was very, very reluctant. Eventually he agreed, and when they went, the farmer took him to the old stone building, and straight away the guy said, that is not the house where I live. I built that stone house. And the farmer was very, very reluctant, but the guy knew where it was. It was on top of the hill. The farmer had destroyed the house, which was illegal. It was a heritage building. So that's why the farmer was very reluctant. So he knew where it was. He knew where he was buried, but he's yet to go to his grave, which would be really weird. But it's all there. You know, check the records. The gravesite is there with his name on it, and his kids as well. Call his kids' names. So much perfect recall. And before then, he was interested in Buddhism, but only on the outside. Now he used to drink. Beer, like Australians. They're taking away a beer from an Australian, like taking a cup of tea away from an Englishman. So, he said to us, he has to give up beer. He has to keep the five precepts. There's no choice anymore. Once he realizes his previous life and how it all works, he's got to be virtuous. That was an interesting part of that, just how it really changed his life, made him a much better person. Simply because when he sees what's happening, whew, you have to keep virtue. So that's one case. Lastly, Jolly Good Show Old Chap for Healthy Bhikkhunis. I like that Jolly Good Show Old Chap. That's why I've been trying to translate some of the suttas into modern English. And there is, for those of you who know some of the teachings, Satipatthana Sutta, dependent of intonation, where Ananda says this teaching Ananda of dependent of intonation is so easy to understand, and the Buddha says, no, don't say that, Ananda, it's very deep. But instead of saying, no, it's very deep, I translated it as, steady on, old chap, steady on, don't say that. So Jolly Good Show, old chap, will be after the Buddha taught the Dharma. Instead of saying, sada, 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 the monks were delighted, you say, very good show, old chap, the monks were delighted. Why not? Put it in modern language. What is your opinion regarding mindfulness meditation training for employees in businesses or corporations? It's okay as far as it goes, but there's much more to it. Mindfulness training makes it more powerful, and also there should be some acknowledgement that it was Buddhist. Do you think this training can help employees regardless of the motor skills and the expectations of trainees, management, employees themselves? Evidence is out there, it does help them. It does help kids at school, that's why people do it. I feel my main source of suffering is regret. I regret things that I've done that I've made my life worse, including speaking with my partner and studying when I was young, and not studying when I was young, but other things that mean my life is worse than it will be otherwise be. How do you know it is worse? We don't know if you did do those things, it could have been much worse. If you'd have stayed with your partner, it could have driven you crazy and suicide. Some partners are like that. If you had studied, you may have become just some crazy professor, and I knew many crazy professors, and they weren't very happy. Who knows what you may have become? That's why we have a word called ineffable. I created that word, not ineffable, but ineffable. The past is ineffable. If I had studied, if I had split with my wife, if I had got dumped by my girlfriend, who knows what might have happened? I don't, no way you can know what happened. So you can't if the past, which is why the past is ineffable. So regret, who knows what might have happened? You can't tell. So that's why, don't go around the past, oh, if I knew I'd done this, oh, if I knew I'd done that, it would probably have been much worse. For example, if you hadn't split with your partner, if you had studied more when you were young, you wouldn't be here today on this retreat. Dear Ajahn, can you talk a little bit about where effort is needed and where it's counterproductive in the spiritual life? Put effort in your work when you leave here. When you're here, take it easy. Come on. Have an experiment of letting go. See what happens. A story of effort and letting go. I don't mind telling you who this monk is. You know Ajahn Manindo up in Northumberland?
Yes.
This is his story. He told me this, and check it out with him next time you see him. He was visiting his homeland of New Zealand, and he was with a friend. They went trekking, they call it tramping in New Zealand. Basically, just walking together. Now, in the wild parts of New Zealand, they were walking all day. They came to this incredible, idyllic beach, middle of nowhere. And no one around. So, you know, Ajahn Manindo and his friend, they didn't have any bathers, so who cares, no one around. Stripped off, took his robes off, and went swimming. But to get cool. That was a really stupid idea, because there were these bad currents on that bay. And he got caught in one of these rip tides. You know, these people drowned because of this. You know, he got taken far out to sea. But he was very wise and it saved his life. He knew he could not fight that current. Now, it just took him further and further out, could not fight it, so he let go. It was a really brave thing that we could see the shoreline going further and further and further and further away. Taken out to sea, that's really scary. But when he got taken further out to sea, about a mile I think he said, from the shore, the current lost its strength. And that's when he started swimming. And he said he got to the shore exhausted, you know, just really close to losing his life. But he said he would have just lost his life if he'd have fought that current. He'd have fought it, swam against the current, and would have still ended up in the same place, a mile out from sea, but from shore, but exhausted, not able to fight back, to swim back. When there was a current which he could not conquer, he let go. When there's something he could do, start swimming, that's when he started. And he only just made it. That is how we learn how to let go. When it's time to do something, then we are ready, we've got our resources, our energy conserved, then we start swimming. So, these are things that actually can change your life and save your life. Very quickly, can you talk about the relationship between identifying with the body and interfering with the breath? I think I mentioned most of that. I'm not quite sure what the question is. Identifying with the body? You don't really identify with the body. This body is just a car you're in for a time being. Some of you have been in your car too long, like me. You know, it's beginning to sort of wear out. Things are beginning to fall off. They creak. And some things don't work like they should do. It really should be taken in to be, actually to get a new model. But I don't want any new models.
So anyway, your body is not you. If you know your body is not you, it's just a vehicle. After a while, you can actually let it go. You look after the body, but you don't really pay too much attention to it. So the breath can also just be let go of. Last question. I often get vivid images and sometimes fantasies. Nothing disturbing my unpleasant. My intuition is that they are positive to be welcomed. But the control freak in me says sometimes I shouldn't be so indulgent. May you grant me the wisdom of action. Thank you so much, kindness. Okay, vivid images. If they are simple images, cultivate them. If they're complicated images, sort of let them go. All you need to do is, if they're disturbing images, just separate yourself from them. So you're watching at a distance, and they tend to just disappear. If they are simple visions, like the beautiful lights, like a moon or something, then they're brilliant. Go for it. But a lot of the times, don't control too much. And sometimes, you know, a meditation retreat can be very boring. And sometimes you get these incredible sort of visions in your mind, which can be very fascinating. Flying through the air, having psychic battles, like with the Hebrew gun, which I did once. Great, great fun. Of course I won, because it's my fantasy. So that's okay to do that, as long as it's not going to be sort of disturbing. Okay, if I didn't answer your question properly, it's because there's many in the end, and it's 10 minutes late.